moxie, force of character, determination, or nerve. I'm Sierra Benson, and you're listening to The Moxie Mindset. This podcast is designed to help you grow a healthier, growth-oriented mindset. I've reached out to college professors and professionals who have agreed to come into the studio to help us learn more in depth about the communication and leadership skills we need to succeed. Thank you for joining us on The Moxie Mindset. I'm super stoked for today's episode.
Alex Romney is an assistant professor in the Marketing and Strategy Department of the John M. Huntsman School of Business at Utah State University. His research is focused on the process of leading, learning, and finding meaning in organizational life. He's especially interested in employee voice and how employees can influence and change their organizations from the bottom up. Dr. Romney earned his BA from Brigham Young University and his PhD in organizational behavior from the University of Utah. He worked as a research associate at the Harvard Business School and taught at the University of Utah prior to his appointment at Utah State University. He teaches courses on leadership and teams.
Welcome on, Professor Romney. I'm so excited to have you on. And I was able to take a class with you last year, right before COVID hit, and it was called Leading Teams. And I love the topics that you brought up in that. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what you brought up in that class, which included leaning, learning, and meaning. What do you make sense of those three things together?
Yeah, thanks so much, Sierra, for having me on. And it's great to chat with you again. Have great memories from that class. So I think in today's world, and I mean, as you know, with the COVID pandemic, with the uncertainty, you know, across the globe, and our you know, our country here in the United States of America, and our sort of station in the world is different than it was and has been in a long time. And it seems like the world's polarized, and we have social justice movements that are occurring and important, and it just seems like change is everywhere, and I think really in that setting, I don't think there's ever been a time in history where we've needed leaders more than we do now. That's a topic that's really something that's near and dear to my heart. I'm reminded of a couple great quotes from people that you may have heard of. I don't know if you remember, Margaret Mead was a sociologist, and she always used to say that we should never doubt the change that a small group of people can accomplish. And so in that, in our class and in my work, one of the things that I'm the most passionate about is helping the younger generation see themselves as leaders and develop leadership abilities. I really believe that leadership is a choice. It's a choice that every individual can make every day when they wake up. And if everybody saw themselves that way and saw every day as a new opportunity to be able to influence others, to help create a better collective society, I think the polarization and the uncertainty and the injustice that we're seeing in the world would dissipate. And the world would just be a better place. And so when I think about, well, if you break that down, what does that really mean? There's really two kind of primary things that I think leaders of the future are going to need to do to be effective. And the first, I think, is that leaders, you know, today, what an organization's best asset is different than it was, you know, during the Industrial Revolution. For the longest time, you know, an organization's, you know, sort of job functions and work processes were very siloed. And so if you think about like Henry Ford, and you think about the even the Toyota production assembly line, you know, everything was focused on individuals knowing sort of one key job function that they fulfilled. And that's not the case anymore. I think more and more now we're seeing that organizations and their work processes and an employee's job function doesn't occur in a silo. And in fact, there's a lot of boundary spanning and a lot of what's called knowledge work that employees are going to be asked to do even more in the future. And so an organization that can learn and has the capacity and ability to learn, really, you know, those are going to be the organizations that are going to be the most effective and that are going to survive in the uncertain times now and in the future. And so when you think about learning, you know, it seems kind of weird. Well, how does an organization learn? You know, it's a composite of individual people, but there's several key principles that organizational learning encompasses. And the first is that you have to have learning processes in place. And what I mean by that is learning occurs from data, from information. And so organizations in the future that are going to be able to learn effectively, they're going to have processes in place where they collect, analyze, and then implement information that they're getting from the front lines of their organization. And so, but not only do they have to have that and, you know, have the mechanisms to collect that information, to analyze it, and then to implement it, they also have to have a culture that encourages and promotes and empowers learning. And there's some really powerful research. I had the opportunity to work with Dr. Amy Edmondson at Harvard Business School. And Dr. Edmondson has really done some groundbreaking research on a concept called psychological safety. And psychological safety, really her identifying it grew out of her research in hospitals. And she's a groups expert. And so she went into a hospital and essentially identified the best teams qualitatively, meaning she went into this hospital and I think she had about 30 different teams that she was examining. And she essentially assessed their dynamics, you know, how trusting were the teams, what were the communication dynamics like, what were sort of what was the status sort of structure within the team. And she watched them and observed them interact over several months. And essentially rank ordered all of these teams from the worst to the best in terms of these dynamics. And then what was interesting is she then said, okay, I also want to get a more objective sort of measure or an outcome for these teams. And she looked at that not qualitatively, but quantitatively. And so she actually looked at the error rates that existed and occurred in each team, meaning, you know, these were teams that were, essentially serving patients and delivering care to patients. And so an error would be, if there was a patient that received the wrong medication or the wrong dosage of medication or any other number of errors that can occur when delivering care to a patient. And so she looked at the rate to which each of these teams committed these errors. And what she found was fascinating. And that was, she found that the rank ordering that she made qualitatively was the complete inverse when she looked at the error rates of these teams quantitatively. Meaning the teams that she qualitatively assessed to be the highest functioning teams with the best dynamics were also the teams that when she looked at the error rates, they were the teams that were committing the most errors. And this was just puzzling to her. She was like, this doesn't make any sense. Well, you know, why would it be that the team that has the most trust, that communicates the best, that has the best sort of hierarchy in place, why in the world would this be the team that commits the most errors? And as she delved deeper into this issue, she identified this sort of counterintuitive finding. And that is that it wasn't the case that the teams that were the best in terms of their dynamics were committing more errors. It was simply the case that in those teams, there existed an environment of safety, what she identifies as psychological safety, that the team members were willing to take interpersonal risks. There was enough safety in those teams that they would admit and report the errors that they made. There's a lot of work in hospitals that hospitals only going to get that information and data if employees and teams self-report. And so that's what she found, was that the teams that were the best in terms of their dynamics had a culture of safety, a psychological safety, where they admitted and reported their errors when they made them. And the teams that had the worst dynamics wouldn't. They had sort of a culture of silence. And because of that, you know, it appears on the surface that they were committing less errors when in fact, in all likelihood, they probably were committing many more errors, but none of the team members felt safe to report them and to express them. And so that becomes a critical thing that leaders can help cultivate and develop in organizations in the future. They can create a climate of psychological safety where individual employees and teams are not only feeling safe to speak up, but they actually are empowered and promoted to speak up. And so that becomes another key piece. And I think then the next piece is essentially having leadership that promotes those aspects of learning. Having leaders that see the importance of collecting data, analyzing it, and acting upon it. You know, a lot of times in organizations or in the world today, it seems like in some cases we're going away from the importance of having objective, good data and acting upon it, at least in some circles. But having a leader who sees the importance of data and making decisions, it becomes important. And then having a leader to promote and create that learning environment, that culture of psychological safety, is really critical. And I think there's a couple things that the leaders can do that. Number one, I think that leaders need to have actual processes in place where they are routinely examining data and collecting it. And depending on the industry and the context in which they're leading, right, that's going to look different. It's going to look different at a hospital than it would at, you know, a company like Amazon or a company like Apple, or it's going to look different at a fire station with, you know, a fire chief. Anyway, but having some way where a leader creates processes where they can collect data, analyze it, and implement it. In terms of creating that climate of psychological safety, there's a lot of research out there that Dr. Edmondson has done that there's critical things that leaders can do to promote that safety. One of them is to diminish the status differences that exist in organization. So if you were to go and look at a hospital, which typically a hospital is very hierarchical, and that's not always a bad thing, but it can inhibit learning. When a low status individual has critical information that could benefit an organization, but doesn't feel safe to bring it up. But if you were to look at a hospital, if you were to assess how psychologically safe each sort of job function felt, you'd find sort of a linear relationship between psychological safety and status. Meaning, a janitor at a hospital is probably going to have the lowest level of psychological safety, and surgeons and doctors are going to have the highest level. And in between there on up, right, you go from a janitor to a CNA to a nurse to, you know, a nurse anesthetist or whatever it is, and then to the doctor and to surgeons. There's a linear relationship between status and psychological safety. And so one of the things that a leader can do to promote psychological safety is they can try to diminish those status differences. In other words, they can try to flatten the hierarchy. And if they're able to do that, psychological safety will improve and increase. And a very important outcome of that is then you're going to get employees engaging in what's called employee voice. Employee voice is a really powerful mechanism for learning from the front lines. And it's actually the topic of most of my research is on how do you create the climate to promote employees to speak up? And then what does effective voice look like? And so I've done a bunch of work that's examined how leaders can develop and cultivate employees to speak up in their organizations. And in that research, essentially, there are three sort of key deterrents that leaders have to overcome in promoting voice. The first is what we've already talked about, and that is creating a climate of safety, because one of the biggest deterrents is fear. Often employees don't speak up when they're fearful of both the social and career consequences that could occur if they speak up. So often employees, you know, feel like, you know, they're going to be looked at as the complainer, or they're going to be, you know, looked at as sort of, you know, rocking the boat. And so there can be negative career outcomes, right, if they voice. And leaders can do a lot to sort of alleviate and do away with that notion. For example, they can solicit voice, and they can also sort of reward employees and celebrate employees that speak up. So fear becomes a really important thing for leaders to overcome in terms of promoting speaking up. The second is often employees don't speak up when they have a feeling of futility, meaning that speaking up is a risky behavior for those frontline employees who engage in it. And so often what happens is when they do speak up, think of when they in a way take the risk to speak up, and yet nothing happens because of it. Nothing's ever acted upon. A feeling of futility begins to develop within the minds of those employees, that there's no good that comes out of it's futile to speak up because nothing's going to change. And so leaders can do a lot to overcome that. They can interview and meet with employees after they speak up, or after they give input or suggestions, and explain to them and clearly identify what's happened with the idea or the issue that they raised. And even if they're not able to act upon it, leaders can at least explain to those employees what's happened. And by doing that, that feeling of futility can hopefully be alleviated. And then the third sort of deterrent that employees often have that makes it difficult for them to speak up is a lack of efficacy. Often it becomes difficult for employees to speak up, not only because they're fearful or they have a feeling of futility, but sometimes individuals just lack their confidence in their ability to speak up effectively. This can be especially true for people who are naturally introverted. And so leaders can do a lot to help grow and improve the confidence that employees have in their ability to speak up. For example, in the hospital, nurses are trained routinely to speak up to doctors using what I call a voice scaffold. And what they're given is they're essentially given an acronym. It's called SBAR. It stands for Situation, Background, Assessment, and Recommendation. And when nurses are trained with this acronym, SBAR, it gives them a scaffold that with, regardless of whatever their issue or idea that they want to speak up to a doctor, this gives them a scaffold of to know how to do it. And so it can give them the confidence that they can do it effectively when they can sort of hang whatever their issue is on each of those components. You know, what's the situation here? What's the background? What's my assessment? And what do I recommend we do? And I think that's something that really could be powerful across not only, you know, in the healthcare hospital settings, but also in, you know, other organizational settings. Having a voice scaffold can improve the efficacy that employees feel to promote voice. So anyway, those are several things that I think leaders can do to promote learning within an organization. And I think that, as I mentioned, Sierra, at the beginning, and I'm sorry, I feel like I've gone on too long, but that becomes this powerful way that leaders can promote learning. Because I really do believe that, you know, we're in the knowledge economy, and the best information, the best data, the best insight, the best learning in any organization is not going to come at the top. It's going to come from the front lines. It's going to come from the bottom. And having mechanisms and a culture in place that's created by a leader to be able to access and act upon that information and that data from the front lines is going to be crucial in the future. It's already crucial now. And I think it's only going to continue to increase in how important that is. And so that becomes a powerful thing that leaders in the future can do, is to point and enable every employee in their organization to be able to see how their daily work, down to the details of what they're doing, how that impacts and influences the purpose and the beneficiaries for which they're working and serving.
So when you're in these university institutions, especially right now with COVID, how can we actually come in contact with main beneficiaries of the organizations we're working in? For instance, USUSA is doing a lot of HOWL activities, but we can't actually touch them, much less be 6 feet in their bubble, you know?
Yeah.
Are there maybe some ways where we can create meaning coming into contact with beneficiaries, but not having to actually meet them? I know I'm struggling with this a lot in my radio stations. Not just in my radio station, but in the university as a whole, I've heard a lot of feeling that the work is meaningless or pointless. It feels like we're kind of just playing a game at this point, trying to pretend it's all real life, you know?
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good question. And I think it's a difficult issue. I think, you know, my sense is thank goodness for technology though. You know, there's a lot of technology that we have that I think we can use more effectively and more widely to, you know, maybe not come in contact with beneficiaries as much physically, but definitely at least to be able to see a face and to be able to talk with somebody in real time. And I think that can be effective. And I think we just need to be more creative now, right? Because we have limitations and because we have these constraints on, you know, coming in contact with them physically. And I sure hope that changes. I think if nothing else, what this time is showing us is how important it is to have physical contact with beneficiaries and others. Like, I think that's an important part of being human and an important part of being healthy. But I think during this time when we have these constraints, I think especially leaders and others, you know, we need to be creative about ways that we can, you know, as I mentioned, come in contact with them, maybe not physically, but, you know, in other ways. Be it over Zoom with Zoom calls or even in sort of our conversations. I think the other thing that we can do is as individuals, I think we need to change how we communicate when it is virtually and when it is maybe not face-to-face. And what I mean by that is, I think often individuals typically will make themselves perhaps more vulnerable if they're face-to-face with somebody. You know, I mean, I guess meaning that there's things that they're more likely to say or share in that setting that maybe they wouldn't virtually. And so I think it just, you know, becomes, you know, all of us, you know, in our interactions to get sort of more meaning out of our conversations and interactions with people. I think if we're willing to make ourselves more vulnerable over those virtual mediums, and for some people, you know, over virtually, maybe it's easier to be vulnerable. And so for those individuals, in some ways, maybe the connection and the contact with those beneficiaries becomes even more meaningful just because it's not as intimidating to do it virtually as it would be in person. But I think, Sierra, the other thing is just, I think it becomes more critical now because we don't have that face-to-face interaction to just remind, maybe not even having conversations, but just always having at the forefront of our minds the purpose for what we're doing something. And very often that comes back to a beneficiary. I don't know if that answers your question, but that those are just some thoughts.
No, it does. It does help. I've just been feeling that with Zoom as well. It does leave a little bit of a disconnect, but it's best when we do lend a little bit of vulnerability into those Zoom calls.
Well, and I know we mentioned this in our class, you know, the thing with vulnerability is that this counterintuitive thing where it's difficult to do. None of us want to be vulnerable, right? We all have sort of inborn tendencies to protect ourselves. And yet, counterintuitively, when we make ourselves vulnerable, that's actually how trust is created and developed. And so, But the trick is, and the catch is there always has to be somebody who's willing to go first to make that vulnerable, you know, stance or action. And then that can sort of, in a way, invite others to also be vulnerable and to be real and authentic. And in doing so, trust grows. And so I think one of the other things is it'd be interesting to look at your interactions or anybody's interactions with individuals that you routinely interact with over Zoom versus those who you might just have like a one-off interaction with. And my sense is that hopefully those individuals that we're having routine conversations, interactions with, hopefully we're, you know, increasing our vulnerability, our willingness to be vulnerable with those individuals. And hopefully the meaning and the connection that can come from those interactions, you know, is improving and growing just because of that. I really do think, even in a COVID world, perhaps even more so, leaders' ability to create meaning becomes critical. And I think it's probably the most important thing that they can do for their employees or in any organization, for a teacher in a class with students or a parent in a family with you know, children. Is just reminding everybody and keeping, you know, at the forefront of their minds what their ultimate purpose is. And very often that's always focused on people. And I'm reminded of a powerful story I shared maybe with you, Sierra, I can't remember, but there's a CEO at Charles Schwab who talked about the most important lesson he learned during his undergraduate experience in college. And he talked about taking a strategy course. He went to NYU, and this is his last semester. He's had straight A's his entire college career. This is his opportunity to graduate, you know, with honors and to keep the 4.0. And he's going into his final exam in the strategy class. and he's studied, he's well prepared, and he gets in and he's waiting for all the other students to file in. And his teacher says, okay, turn over your exam. And he turns it over and he's shocked. Of all the theories that they've gone over in this business strategy class, there's one question on the exam that's, in his mind, totally unrelated. And his teacher says, this is the most important question of everything that I could and have taught you this semester. If you can answer this question, you pass the exam, ace it. If you can't, you fail. And for him, if he failed, this means that he not only, you know, was going to get a B in this class, but he was also going to lose that 4.0. And the one question on this piece of paper was, who is the janitor who cleans this building? And the CEO, for the life of him, couldn't remember the individual's name. He had seen her many, many times. In fact, had seen her almost every time, every day that he'd gone to class there at that building. And yet he never stopped to know her name. And anyways, now that he's the CEO of Charles Schwab, he talked about how, even though that was his one B and a failing final grade, that was the most important lesson that he learned. And so the reason I share that is that's meaningful. And I think having leaders do what that professor did and reminding individuals that we work with to keep the main thing the main thing. And the main thing is always people. And if we can remember that and remember the beneficiaries for whom we're working and serving and leading, I think that's going to bode well for our future, not only for society at large, but for us as individuals. And so I think having leaders who can promote learning and promote meaning are really going to be the two most important things that leaders can do to bring us on into the future.
Thank you so much, Professor Romney. I really needed that story today, actually. So thank you. I just have a couple more questions for you. The first question is, what would you tell your younger self?
That's a great question, Sierra. I think I would tell myself a couple things. I think number one, I would tell myself that I'm far better than I think I am. Sometimes life has a way of making us see ourselves as less than we really are. And I think a lot of the ways that we're evaluated in school, at jobs, whatever it might be, can kind of create that vision. But I really believe that the best performance and the happiness that we all want in our lives comes from how we see ourselves. And I think when I was younger, I didn't see myself clearly. And one of the ways I didn't see myself clearly is I didn't see just how good and great I could be. And so I think that would be one thing. I think the other thing is I would tell my younger self that hard work is far, far more important than talent. In growing up, I had experiences at times where my talent could compensate for my, quite frankly, laziness. And while that was okay, you know, in a given performance, you know, whether it was in sports or at school or whatever it might be, the problem with that is it creates a habit of not giving it your best. And so I wish I could have told myself just how much more important work is than talent. And so I think that would be the second thing. I think the third thing that I would probably tell my younger self is that failure is how we learn. And to embrace failure. You know, and when I say failure, I'm not saying failure that is premeditated. What I mean by that is, you know, failure that is when somebody tries to fail or is negligent in their responsibility. I mean, I'm not talking about that. I think that's immoral in my view. I'm talking about when you've really tried to give a decent effort at something and you failed. I wish I could tell my younger self that that's how you learn, and to some ways to try to celebrate those. So I think that would be the other thing. And then I think the last thing is, I think I would tell my younger self, the people you really love are the people that you should spend the most time with and worry the most about. And I think too often when I was younger, you know, I think back when I was in high school is the best example. I mean, I remember so often being worried, and I'm not even in high school, in college as well, especially when I was in undergrad. I remember times when I was so concerned about what other people might have thought of me in a given, you know, and it's so interesting to think back, because I don't talk with or worry or have seen most of those people for 20 years or something. And yet in the moment, especially when you're a teenager in high school is the worst, where it's like, you are always so concerned and so socially, you know, conscious in a bad way, you're too worried about what other people think. And so I think the last thing is I wish I could tell myself that none of that mattered, and that you just need to worry about, you know, what do the people I love think of me, and to worry more about them, to spend more time with them. So yeah. And then I guess there's a fifth thing that comes to me as well. I think the other thing that I would, share, and that's something that one of my heroes once was told, and that is to forget yourself and go to work. I think too often when I was younger, I was too concerned about myself. And I think there's something so therapeutic and something so invigorating in losing yourself and striving to serve other people, whether that's at work, at school, and I think most importantly, and especially in your family. So I don't know. I think those would be the five things that I would tell myself. I mean, I could probably go on and on here, because I wish I was better when I was younger. And so there was so many things that I wish that I probably would want to tell myself. But those would be five.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that a lot of those have been the same ones that the previous people on this podcast have said.
Yeah.
Almost all of them have been said. And I think it says something about how we view ourselves when we're younger. Yeah. Because I see myself all the time self-criticizing, hoping that, you know, I'm dressing the right way for this certain party, all of these things. And it's liberating to hear that all of those things are a hindsight when you get older.
Yeah.
So thank you.
No, my pleasure. Yeah. I mean, you think about, honestly, Sierra, I think about my high school, for example. I talked to maybe two people in the last, you know, I graduated in 2001. So it's been 19 years since I graduated high school. And I think I've talked to maybe two people from my high school in the last 19 years, which is crazy.
Yep.
You know, and even my undergrad, I know. I think about my undergrad. I mean, I met my wife in my undergrad. So I definitely talk to people from my undergrad more, but, but still, I mean, you know, yeah. So anyway, I think when it all comes down to it, I think the most important thing is, you know, being true to yourself and not beating yourself up, and remembering, you know, we just had the the NBA championship, I watched sports a little bit, and Pat Riley, who's one of these great coaches, players, executives in the NBA, has the saying, and it becomes the culture of the Miami Heat. And that is, you have to always keep the main thing the main thing. And I think that's good advice in life. And the main thing in life is the people you love and the people you're going to spend your life with. And that's your family and the people, your friends who are close to you. And so anyway, if you can remember that and remember, you know, those people who are most important to you, I think that's what brings happiness in life and fulfillment and wholeness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. I'm definitely still finding that, but we're working on it. Thank you, Professor Romney. And the last question is, where can we find you? Is there any research that has been published? If you have an office and you're taking in-person office hours?
Yeah, I have an office. I'm in the Eccles Business Building, room 419. You can also, if people really, I would be shocked if people actually are interested in reading my research, but yes, I do research. You can see, I have a Google Scholar profile. You can see a bunch of articles that I've written. And I also have a website that's just alexanderromney.com and tells a little bit more about kind of my work and teaching and whatnot.
Great.
So yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Pat. Happy to do it. This is great and excited to see this podcast that you're doing, Sierra. I think that's awesome.
Thank you. I hope you have a great one, Professor Romney.
All right. Hey, you too.
Hey, it's Sierra, and I hope you enjoyed that episode. I hope it led you to a more positive mindset, a more defined view of leadership, and some action items to take along with you. For more information, you can check out the Moxie website at themoxiemindset.org. Thanks for tuning in today, and I'll see you next week on The Moxie Mindset.